Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Kaplan Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm fine.
Yeah?
It's lovely.
It's all good?
It's all good. I thank you for the breakfast you brought me. here in the studio, live on the Restaurant Guys, we're allowed to eat in the studio. None of the other talk show hosts are allowed to eat, just us, we can eat.
Because we have to.
It's
our job.
It's research.
It is our job. I brought my pal Francis a true Jersey breakfast this morning. What I brought him was this...
A pile of toxic waste.
No,
a sludge sandwich.
I, of course, as being the restaurant guy that I am, I fried up a couple of vegetarian-fed organic eggs, cage-free organic eggs.
Delicious.
In some delightful Amish butter, which I had in my house. I shaved over it some three-year-aged Vermont cheddar. I crushed some fresh black pepper. Of course, I seasoned with a little bit of Maldon sea salt. And then I added the famous Jersey ingredient, pork roll.
Yeah. Not exactly ecologically in keeping with the rest of the sandwich, but mighty tasty, I must say.
It is. So what is it about? We should call Stephen Witherly and find out, our food scientist friend, and find out why we like pork roll so much.
Everything. But it's salt, it's fat, it's smoke, it's spice, it's delicious.
It's everything's there. It's, you know, you have the bread, you have the carbohydrates from the bread, you have the protein, you have the salt. It's
the runny
all
egg.
The umami from the cheddar cheese. It's all there, baby.
Delicious. Well,
so the other thing, though, Francis, and that we have to touch on today, now that we've had breakfast and it's out of the way,
mm-hmm.
is I was reading. I wasn't at work last night, but you were, and maybe you can explain some of Francis and I. Every night we do a service log and a bar log and a kitchen log, and those get emailed out to all the people in the respective departments.
And you read the log this morning.
A little disturbing. Maybe you could tell me exactly what happened and everybody else at the same time.
Anytime the fire department comes to the restaurant, trust me, it's disturbing. Okay, here's the story. We get a rather confusing telephone call comes down to the office through our host. It's concierge of a hotel that you can see from our place. And it says someone on the upper floors of the hotel can see flames and can see flames. They can see fire. Do we have a fire? And we say, I don't know. I don't think we have a fire. And the concierge of the hotel or the front desk of the hotel says, one of our guests on an upper floor is looking down on your building, and they see a fire. There must be a fire on the roof.
That's
or
what
behind
I read.
So I call the fire department. Or I had Sherry call the fire department, and I immediately...
Which is the next logical step, and we're laughing. Obviously, this doesn't turn out badly. But
Well, I go to grab the pizza guy, because downtown New Brunswick, all the buildings are touching. Okay, mm-hmm. They're all touching. And so there's a landlocked courtyard between his building and our triangular building, and I figure the fire is behind the building. That's the only place it can be. So I go, I run over, and I grab him, and then I run upstairs. Just as the fire department is arriving, the deputy chief of the fire department is there and a police officer. I'm like, come on, upstairs. We run upstairs, and we're looking around. There's no fire. It's just there's no smoke. There's no fire. I'm thinking, is this a false alarm? Is someone messing with me? I don't get it. So the fire chief says, you know, as my dad was a fire chief, as you know, and he always said, you know, better false alarm.
Right, take it seriously. Take that call seriously.
Like, call us. Don't investigate and call us. Call us and then investigate.
Right.
So that's what we said. We got the fire trucks outside. Can you valet park a fire truck? Anyway. So we go downstairs, and we write it off. We can't figure out
one thing that I know for sure, though, people walk into a room with fire trucks in front of it and firemen in it. Very cautiously.
Yeah, yeah. We should try with a little bit.
Customers kind of like, I don't know if I want to eat here.
I'm leaving. So, about an hour or two goes by, and this lovely couple from the hotel came in and had sat down in Catherine Lombardi, table 12, right next to the fireplace, and said, So, how are you tonight? And the captain said, oh, well, it's been kind of an eventful night. The fire department's here earlier. They said, yeah, we saw the fire department here from our window. We actually, was there a fire? And I said, no, some guests from the hotel, they supposedly called and said there was a fire, but there was no fire. And the lady put her hand over her mouth. And she said, I think that was us. And we said, what do you mean? And the captain said, what do you mean? And they said, well, we were staying in the hotel. We're from out of town. We're staying in the hotel across the street. And from our window, you can see into your window in the restaurant. And we saw that a fireplace. And we thought, oh, that's a lovely restaurant with a fireplace. We love to dine by fireplace. So I called the front desk and I said, hi, this is, Janice from room 312. That restaurant across the street, do they have a fire? And the front desk clerk may have had a little language issue and said, there's a fire in the restaurant across the street? And she said, no, I'm looking into the window of the fireplace, into the window of the restaurant across the street,
and
I see
fire.
A fireplace. Do they have a nice fireplace? Is that a nice place to go to dinner? And the front desk clerk said, you see fire in the window of the restaurant across the street? And she said, no, I see a fireplace. Is that what it is? And I said, yeah, I'll take care of it.
Oh, never mind.
And then he called us, and anyway, and then we called the fire department.
The fire trucks came, and then
people
had dinner next to the fire. That's great.
There were indeed flames in the window.
Did they bring marshmallows?
There were indeed flames in the window, but they were supposed to be there. Definitely supposed to be there. So very romantic.
Controlled fireplaces.
Yeah.
So anyway, how we discovered this, and Francis and I, we'll probably touch on this in another show, but how we Francis and I communicated this particular fact was we used our service logs.
Yeah, it's amazing how the 21st century has changed. We run our restaurant in an old-fashioned way in a lot of ways, very personal, but every night the bartender, the maitre d', and the chef of each restaurant send an email out to everybody else who's in that level of our staff and us included, and the bookkeeper as well, and the office manager. And so every night there's a report from every bar, and it's just, it's we started it because our insurance company wanted us to keep a management log, and we kept losing it. So, because you'd write in it, and then it'd wind up somewhere. It's harder to keep track of stuff at 2 o'clock in the morning.
It is harder to keep track
so
of stuff.
So what we do now is this little log that everyone writes, and it goes to all the key people in the organization every night, and it's dated. I keep them in a file. I have 5 years of management log, and what's better, well, not management log, service notes. Management log is what Mark and I keep with each other. But I have these notes on what happened every night, and because of modern technology, because of the internet, I can do a keyword search, and right. I can, search up fire, and last night's going to come up, for example. But it actually comes in very handy because, people love to sue restaurants for some reason.
Yeah, that's
a big thing. I mean, every restaurant I've ever worked in is always being sued by somebody. You slip and fall within a block of the place, you sue me. And it's really great. We are able to give detailed notes anytime there's an incident or anything happens, or if we want to look back on, what was it like last year? I can just read through the service
right.
notes, and I get more than just by seeing how many people came in. And it's a way to, and I see what regular customers came in or people I knew, and it keeps everybody on the same page, and it keeps us all in touch.
One of the things that it does, let's say, I happen to be off on Monday nights, and such regular customer has been in on Monday nights. I now know at least I haven't lost touch with that customer. We're not connecting.
Well, and it's a way to use modern technology to do an old-fashioned thing, which is to enhance our ability to show hospitality to people, which is what it's all about. Hey, you've heard us talk about locavores and eating locally a lot on this show. We're going to bring on, after the break, a guy named James McWilliams, who's written a pretty interesting article that has some counterintuitive observations about eating locally, and it should be a pretty lively discussion. I hope you'll stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. This is Francis Schott. We're with Mark Pascal. We're joined today by James McWilliams. He's a fellow in agrarian studies program at Yale University. He is a locavore himself and an advocate for responsible and sustainable agriculture. He recently wrote a controversial article demystifying the Eat Local movement and pointing out some things that may be counterintuitive and have brought a hailstorm of criticism on him from otherwise like-minded people.
James, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Hey, man, people are you've really caused a lot of discussion about a pretty serious topic.
People are throwing hail at you.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, I touched a nerve.
You did touch a nerve, but I think it's a pretty interesting thing, and it's when I read it, I thought, oh, I never thought of that. You know, because we advocate trying to, as do you, live sustainably on this planet. And what, just for those of you out in the audience who don't know what the locavore movement or the eat local movement is all about, I mean, we have, if you listen to the show, you've heard us talk about it a lot. It's about buying from local farmers, and there are a lot of reasons to do that. One is to keep open spaces in your communities. The other is to keep farmers in your communities. The other is to keep your local economy rounded. But one of the advantages touted for the local food movement that is really struck a nerve and you see everywhere is this concept of food miles, that when we eat locally, the food doesn't have to come as far and is therefore has less of a carbon footprint, as
less energy input into the food.
But that may not be true. Isn't that your thesis, James?
Well, yeah, it's a pretty complicated argument. And I will say a lot of the criticism has been, I think, a result of distorting my argument. In no way am I suggesting that eating local is something we shouldn't be doing. It's something that I do, and it's something that we should do as often as we can. All I'm trying to point out, and I think it's a critical point, and I'll explain why in a minute, is that, food miles is just one measure of sustainability. And what scientists are finding out is that it's a pretty modest measure. There are so many other factor inputs that go into, bringing food from, the farm to the plate, that the one factor of food miles becomes, I would never say insignificant, but it has to be put in a larger context. So there are so many other energy inputs that we have to measure, and when you start doing that, the picture gets a bit more complicated than just, hey, if I buy my food locally, then I'm automatically supporting this ethic of sustainability.
But if you want hundreds of millions of people to change what they're doing, doesn't it have to be kind of a simple formula? If the formula is too complex,
well,
won't
a lot
that
of
muddle
ways,
the picture?
You're absolutely right, but I think also in a lot of ways that's the problem is food miles is simple. I mean, it's something that any consumer can get their mind around, and I think evidence of this, the sort of inherent simplicity of it, is the push in England in particular to label products with food miles. Now, the optimistic interpretation of this is hey, it still can be simple. And I tried to push in my article, or at least introduce in my article, this idea of life cycle assessments. And a life cycle assessment is a kind of term that encompasses what I had just mentioned earlier. It includes the entire life cycle of a product and measures virtually every energy input imaginable. So the consumer wouldn't have to walk around thinking, oh, I better think about water, I better think about packaging, I better think about the kind of fuel that was used when it traveled, what kind of feed did the animal eat. Instead, perhaps down the road someday, we could have life cycle labels or life cycle indicators rather than food mile indicators.
What James is talking about may seem a little far-fetched to us, but in England they're really ahead of where we are in being concerned about how far your food travels. And so there are proposals that your food have on it how many food miles it traveled. So your New Zealand lamb, if you're in London, will have a certain number of miles on the label, mm-hmm. As opposed to, if you got it from Surrey. Where it will have, 100 miles on the label. So why don't you explain to people how it's possible that, and you pointed this out in your article, and it's brilliant, it really got my mind working, how it's possible that someone in London can actually have a greater carbon impact by buying conventional lamb locally than buying conventional lamb from New Zealand, let's say, which is so far away.
Yeah, this is a study done in New Zealand a couple of years ago, and, I will point out, at the front here, it's important to say that New Zealand clearly has an interest in minimizing.
Yeah, it sounded like the study might have been done by lamb farmers the way it came
out.
Yeah,
right. And in fact, the study was peer reviewed, and it has gotten a great deal of international support, and it has been replicated in other countries with other products as well. So, having said that, the study basically showed that if you bought lamb locally, conventionally produced lamb locally in England, it was four times more inefficient than if you bought lamb.
How is that possible?
Grass-fed lamb that had come from New Zealand. Now, of course, from a food mile perspective, you go, that's crazy. That's just not possible. That defies logic. But this is where I think life cycle assessments have such great potential for how we think about food. The study did a life cycle assessment of lamb produced in New Zealand, and it found that the energy inputs in particular into what the lamb ate was minimal compared to what the lamb had to eat in England.
You know, let's take a quick break, and we're going to come back and talk more about this. But the idea that even though the New Zealand lamb traveled so much further, it was grazing an open pasture in New Zealand, whereas it was a very intensive farming operation that got the
basically
the
lamb. You had to ship the food for the lamb, and that cost.
And it was an intensive farming operation to raise the animal in England.
Yeah,
and,
that's right.
And that the carbon footprint was much greater from eating the local lamb. Fascinating stuff. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with James McWilliams, a fellow in the Agrarian Studies Program at Yale University. We're talking about local food, food miles, and, taking it a little more than just very lightly, how we can eat a little more responsibly.
So, James, what we were talking about right before the break is people eating lamb in England might actually be better off eating lamb from New Zealand than eating lamb in England. And we talked about, you know, whether it's the food costing more or the lamb costing more or the waste removal. Help us get our arms around how that could possibly be.
Right. Again, it does seem counterintuitive, but I think the gist of it comes down to the overall energy inputs, and the overall energy inputs into the New Zealand lamb are very low because they're grazed. They're grazed on natural clover. The comparative advantage to
producing nobody
lamb in New Zealand is far outweighs producing lamb in England, so much so that it far outweighs the cost of shipping and the carbon input of shipping.
Well, you know, and the thing to remember is, number one, it's interesting to look at this because I think we all come from the same point of view as to how to best act responsibly for our planet. And we're all very concerned with agriculture with acting in a sustainable way. But what we need to do is be honest here and say, okay, well, this little leg of the platform, this plank in the platform needs to be rethought. Now, one of the things I want to talk about after the news is that the people in the food industry have sort of picked up on this, distorted your argument, and sort of presented it as, you know, Jason McWilliams wrote this article saying this whole eat locally craze is bunk. Don't do it. You know, it's bad.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
the risk we take. But that's why you're listening to the Restaurant Guys, and we have a whole hour to talk about this and have a bit of a nuanced position.
It's not really bunk.
We love nuance. We're going to talk about the upsides and downsides of eating locally and eating well after the news. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcasts on iTunes.
James McWilliams is a fellow in the Agrarian Studies program at Yale University. He is a locavore, but recently wrote a much-talked-about article demystifying the Eat Local movement in at least one regard and bringing into question the idea that food miles alone should be what people consider when we decide that we want to eat locally. The point of the article was that sometimes, if I can paraphrase our discussion to this point in your article a little bit, if you live in a place where it takes a lot of resources, like England, where in order to raise a lamb you need to give it feed, which is very intensive and requires a lot of energy input, and that is very close, you may indeed wind up creating more carbon footprint than if you transport a lamb from a place that can grow up much more efficiently, like New Zealand, where there are no people. No, I mean, there are very few people, and there's lots of wide open space, and the lambs just sort of graze in the field. So that's the premise of your article so far. Did I get that about right?
Yeah, I think that's on the right track for sure.
Well, so let me throw a quote back to you, and I let's bring the discussion in this area. And I believe this is a quote from you. It says, so does this call to arms against an exclusive food mile assessment suggest that we should stop eating local, rip off the sticker on our bumper, and head to the nearest Walmart? Of course not. It means that we as individuals and consumers as environmentalists should place the act of eating locally in a broader perspective. Talk to us about that broader perspective.
Yeah, and what I meant with that sentence was, I think it's important that we don't look at eating local and eating global as oppositional ideas. I mean, they're by no means mutually exclusive. And one of the benefits of really thinking in terms of life cycle assessments, a broader understanding of how our food is produced that goes beyond food miles, is we can see that in many cases the goal of sustainability, which I share with, I think, all locavores, the goal of sustainability can be achieved by eating a global diet. Not in every case, perhaps not even in most cases, but the fact of the matter is we have to be more sophisticated than mere food miles. And I become very frustrated. It seems like any time I get into a conversation at a dinner party about food, food miles comes up and people begin to sort of flash their green credentials by saying, hey, I got everything that we're eating here locally. And it just strikes me as simplistic. And I think it works for some people in some areas and regions and some contexts. But I'm really thinking about the fact that, you know, the world is almost reaching 7 billion people, and food is going to move. Food is going to travel. And given that reality, I think locavores need to branch out and think about ways that we can have a global system of food trade that is sustainable. And this encourages us to think about things like comparative advantage and concentrating food production in places where the natural conditions are appropriate for that food production.
Well, one of the expressions you use to talk about those friends at those dinner parties that you were just discussing is light green, as opposed to a green movement. That they're kind of light green. They have good desires, but necessarily they may not have have formulated the entire picture.
Yeah, the phrase is certainly not mine, but it is starting to get traction as the popular criticism of, I think, what's considered kind of the easy way out in terms of being environmentally conscious. And I think food miles is, in many cases, an expression of light green because it's easy. And for people who can afford to buy local organic produce from a farmer's market, I mean, it requires extra time, it requires extra money. And the fact that they're doing that is I think, very good. On the other hand, we have to be careful about universalizing our own, privileged culinary experience and thinking that that can be a model for the world as a whole. Thinking in terms of global food systems and how we can have sustainable global food trade, I think, requires making some very hard decisions. And, you know, it's just not very sexy to... It's not environmentally very sexy to start thinking about, you know, comparative advantage and water inputs and fertilizer inputs. I mean, this kind of terminology doesn't lend itself to a little bumper sticker on the back of the old Volvo.
You know, I'll kind of compare it to back in the wine world in the 70s and 80s. A lot of people drank white Zinfandel. Yeah. And, you know, we in the wine world are pleased by that because those people eventually grew to a broader understanding of wine because they started drinking white Zinfandel. So to me... Drink white Zinfandel if you want. Eventually, you'll probably want more complex things. And I think that the whole eat local movement is very similar, analogous to that.
I also think that, I mean, we're talking about food miles and how people sort of are looking for an ultimate shorthand. And this is a shorthand that will eventually lead us down the wrong road. If that's the only thing that we consider, and you talk a lot about broader context, there are a lot of other reasons to eat locally. Like, if you like having farms in your community, then you better buy something from them, you know. If you like having open space in your community that's not purchased by the county at taxpayer expense, then you'd better buy from your local farmer. But that doesn't mean that, you know, everything good we say about buying locally is true.
I think this is a really important point to make. I mean, there are, beyond the issue of sustainability, there are very good reasons for buying local, and you've just mentioned a couple of them. I mean, preserving open space. Often, not always, but often local food is safer.
And it's often tastier.
Yeah, it's often tastier, but then I start thinking about coffee, and I start thinking about wine, and I start thinking about truffles. And
wild Alaskan salmon.
Yeah, and so it's true for... certainly, you know, fruits and vegetables. But
the coffee beans grown in New Jersey really aren't very good. You know,
right.
Well, you know, you also talk about you quote a lot of Barbara Kingsolver and Michael Pollan with the Omnivore's Dilemma. These people who've really taken this and explored it, and I give them great kudos. And I think it's tremendous to explore this topic and try and eat locally. But Smith and McKinnon, their book. What was their book again? Right. They talk about undertaking a 100-mile diet in Vancouver, Canada, British Columbia, where they eat everything from within 100 miles. Well, you know, in Vancouver, they wind up, you quote, they became incredibly creative cooks, twist and turn to stretch a grossly limited food supply into meals, quote-unquote, that they somehow manage to stoically enjoy, even if they are anxiously having discussions about weight loss, scurvy, and protein deficiency, while nibbling on stored turnips and worried about lowered sex drives. By the way, the last one is what would 100-mile diet if I'm in Vancouver is out for me because of that. But, you know, if you're in... you know, New Jersey, you get a pretty seasonal diet. If you're in California, eating locally is pretty darn easy. If you're in Tucson, Arizona, you're in the middle of a desert. You better like cactus.
Yeah, it's, again, I think it goes back to the universalizing issue. I have absolutely the utmost respect for Smith and McKinnon, and they keep a blog, and it's really interesting to read. I respect them tremendously for their... You know, their discipline and their emphasis on eating local, and the same goes for Barbara Kingsolver, and to an extent Michael Pollan. But again, two things come to mind immediately. One is, can we take this model of restraint, sacrifice, awareness, and universalize it? I mean, is this something that we can apply to on a national, international, global level to achieve a goal of sustainability? And the realist in me says, not a chance in hell.
Well, we're Americans. No way.
Yeah, we don't like to make sacrifices.
You said restraint and sacrifice. There's no chance.
Yeah,
right. And I guess the other issue is this exclusive emphasis on food miles. And this is where I am quite critical of these authors, because I think they do cast the matter as an either-or proposition. Either you're eating imported food and being environmentally irresponsible, or you're eating locally and being environmentally responsible. And to me, that's an irresponsible argument to make. You know, I don't need to tell either you guys, or probably most of your listeners, that, you know, it sells books.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, I think that they broached the topic, and we're taking the discussion to a deeper level in the restaurant guys, because that's just what we do. Hold on one second. We'll be back in just a moment, talking more with James McWilliams about these, you know, below the surface of eating locally. In just a moment, you're listening to the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. Time is 11:46.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 US patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys. We're talking with James McWilliams. He's a fellow in the Agrarian Studies program at Yale University. And for those of you who listen to our show in broadcast and in podcast, we are the eggheads of the food world. What we do here is we take a topic and you know, we go beyond the simple, and we try to actually have a serious discussion about it. And I thank you all for, you know, we're wrapping your heads around this. It ain't bubblegum, it ain't Britney Spears.
Francis and I were discussing at the break that perhaps that if you got turned on the show at 30, you know, halfway point, you're kind of going, huh?
Yeah.
What are they talking about exactly?
Well, we are talking about food miles and how if you want to eat strictly locally, well, then there would be a lot of places where you just can't live. We had on, James, we had on a show, oh, God, a long time ago in 2005. We had a guy named Richard Manning who wrote Against the Grain and a book called Grassland. He's an environmental investigative reporter, and he basically came to the conclusion that the prairie states, that a prairie environment can be used to grow food for a while, and then it exhausts no matter
right.
what.
Right. Well, that's what happened throughout the entire 19th century. I mean,
the Dust Bowl is the natural reaction to non-chemical agriculture in the plains.
Yeah, I mean, the Dust Bowl was a man-made disaster. It was due to the removal of the native grass, and you know, grazing that area pretty much turned it into a region that was completely unsuitable to producing food. But samples taken from 150 years ago reveal soil that was some of the most fertile in the world.
Well.
It was Richard Manning's contention that we should just simply move out of those places.
Or at least
stop
farming.
Yeah, and again, this goes back to the realism issue. Sure, in a perfect scenario, everyone would move like Barbara Kingsolver did from, you know, a dry a region where you can't sustainably produce food to southern Virginia, where the conditions are ideal to a year-round locally produced diet. And you know, again, the 7 million people in the world issue here needs to come up. Is this a realistic model for achieving sustainable food production? I don't think so. Is it something that we should do on a personal level if we can to and want to? Absolutely.
Well, you know, the idea is, you know, we're not going to close Arizona. Can I go to Arizona? No, I'm sorry, it's closed. We all moved out.
You can just visit. You cannot live there.
Exactly. And you have to eat cactus when you're there. Well, so what is the... You talk about sort of a rudimentary idea that in your article, the sort of a hub and spoke production of agriculture. So let me see if I get this right. You're talking about suggesting that we find the places where we can most sustainably grow food.
Yeah, this is a tricky argument to make, mainly because so little has been done in this direction. But when I look at the current structure of food subsidies in this country right now, I mean, it's a lot of people are aware of this, but the subsidies support really the wrong things. They do not support sustainable production. Instead, the vast majority of subsidies in this country support agribusiness, corn, soybeans. What if you restructured the subsidy system? I mean, it would take enormous political will, but to create incentives for growers, for food producers, to produce in certain regions of the country, of the world, what have you, whatever scale you want to think on, and those incentives were followed up upon so that you did have the production of certain kinds of food where they should be produced. And what I mean by should is where it would be most sustainable to produce those goods. It doesn't seem that unrealistic of a leap to me. It's certainly more realistic than envisioning people moving to more fertile regions.
Well, especially if you look at it in the way that Francis and I usually do, which is that the best foods will come from the place where they're most easily sustainably
absolutely.
Produced.
I mean, you'll have better tasting food. You'll have environmentally efficiently produced food. But there would have to be a system of incentives in place because, as we made the point earlier, Americans aren't running out being virtuous for the sake of being virtuous. We follow incentives.
Let's also point out that incentives are very powerful. And let me anticipate the argument from the Center for Consumer Freedom when they listen to the show, and I hope they do, which is a right-wing front group for industry. What they would say is, well, you know, here you are telling us what we can eat and what we can't. And we're not. We're talking about subsidizing or putting incentives out there to move to places that are more responsible. And before you listen to anybody who says, well, incentives are, you know, it's coming from tax dollars and they're going to raise your taxes to do it. Okay, your tax dollars are already high because right now we have incentives because those big agribusiness companies are getting huge monster subsidies. So I'm not talking about raising your taxes. I'm talking about, and Jason is talking about taking away the huge monster subsidies we now have in place to subsidize large corporations for doing things wrong.
That incentivize the crop and not the farmer
as well. That give them incentive to do what's wrong and hurt the planet and take those subsidies and instead give them to farmers who would do things that are good for the planet and good for our food and good for the health.
Yeah, and I think in terms of public opinion, we're getting closer and closer to that. The public awareness that the subsidies in this country support, unsustainable production is becoming much higher than it's ever been before.
We're getting there in public awareness, but we're not getting there in lobbying dollars. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment with James McWilliams in just a moment. 1450 WCTC, time is 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're speaking with James McWilliams about eating locally. You know, James, one of the things that here is that nobody is writing impassioned volumes about their personal experiences carpooling in a hybrid for a year. Yet, you said that.
Yeah.
Now, people are very passionate about food as it relates to environmentalism. Well, you really can't just get very passionate about, you know, the act of it. Like, you may do something, but then you don't, like, live it. Why is food, so resonant?
I don't want to be too skeptical here, or maybe the word cynical, but I think it sells. I mean, I think it just has this great appeal to the marketplace. And if you want to push an idea, doing it through food is a brilliant way to do it. And the reason why I included that comment about nobody writing books about carpooling in a hybrid is the point I'm trying to make is that there are so many ways as individuals that we can reduce our carbon footprint, and of course, eating locally produced and sustainably produced food is just one way. But it seems like the bulk of the emphasis goes on that.
I also let me throw my conjecture out there is I think that, you know, food is very powerful, and the communal meal is the basis of human interaction, really. And I think that there's just a psychological power, that comes from eating what you do every day, which is why our show is relevant to people.
Right.
Eating every day, you eat every day, you eat with your family, and you take it into you. And I think
constantly thinking about our next meal.
There's no doubt. And you guys are absolutely right that, I mean, food hits you in the gut, and it's a great way to make a point. And I wrote a book on early American food, and I wanted to get other points, but I did it through food because it has this intuitive appeal. But, I mean, wouldn't you argue that just as central to our lives is transportation, getting from point A to point B?
No,
transportation is what I need.
Food. To get to the restaurant.
Right.
All right, listen, we need to leave it.
When I make food choices, I make the ones I want as well as the ones I need.
We need to leave it there. James, thank you for coming on the show
fun,
with
guys.
Us.
Thank you.
It was great to have you. Hope you enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys. 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.